Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hello everyone, my name is Joe Stoll. I'm very excited to bring you this exciting, but not very happy, episode of the Silmarillion Seminar. In this episode, we will discuss Chapter 23 of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin. This short chapter has a lot packed into it, and it involves many things falling from great heights. And yes, of course, Balrogs are included in this, because they don't have physical wings that they fly with, only shadows that look like wings. Anyway, let me give you some examples of topics that we discuss. The childhood of Tuor, how humbly he was brought up, and also how different his childhood was from that of his cousin, Turin. We discuss how Tuor received the short end of the stick at first, and became a slave at a young age. There is a brief recap of some elven geography. We also take a look at how this chapter may or may not reflect different writing styles of Tolkien. How Turgon flat refuses the message from Olmo, and ultimately turns on help from the West. We also discuss different elf women and male men relationships throughout Tolkien's works. We go in depth into the Fall of Gondolin and discuss whether or not Turgon dies as a coward, how Maeglin mirrors his dad, and how Mist can be mournful. I hope you enjoy these topics, and all of the others that we jump into in this episode, which is titled, Maeglin, the Apple Doesn't Fall Far from the Tree.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I here interrupt myself in order to bring you myself. Hi, this is Corey Olson. We are going to begin the live broadcast of this week's episode of the Silmarillion Seminar. I actually kind of hate to interrupt the rebroadcast of our announcement show for the Mythgard Institute last night, but that's okay. It will be on again later on. But tonight we bring you something different. We are on to Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin. Another week, another mighty civilization falls in the latter part of the Quintus Silmarillion. Without further ado, let us get into our discussion of the text here. We start with Tuor. Now, with the beginning of Tuor's story, we return back to after the Nirnaeth Arnoidead, and therefore those of us who have, having had almost a month of Turin and family in between, might not recall that. So let's, of course, start by recalling the apposite details that we will want to recall. That is, we remember that Tuor is the son of Huor, who is the brother of Hurin, and although Hurin was the one who survives and remains is taken to Angband. Huor is shot in the head at the end of that battle and dies. But you will recall his significant prophecy that he makes to Turgon, and we'll go back and look at that. But anyway, so Tuor is his son, and you will recall also that at the very beginning of the chapter on Tuor and Turambar, we are told that Rian, who is Tuor's mom, upon hearing of the death of Huor and almost everybody else in the Nirnaeth Arnoidead, goes and lays herself down upon the Hill of Slain and dies. So now we have Tuor growing up as an orphan. And I guess my first question with Tuor, the first thing that we see obviously is sort of the parallels, or at least the potential parallels between Turin and Tuor. You know, we've got these guys who are cousins. Both of whom are, you know, T names after their dad's H names. And the obvious family connection. And, you know, so looking at both of them as sort of quasi-orphans, Tuor literally an orphan, and Turin sort of, his early life rather complicated by the Nirnaeth. But we see them both put in a similar situation. What did you guys notice or think about the differences? We spent some time talking about Turin's childhood and his situation when he was a kid. What did you make of Tuor's situation? How do you think they're different? Is there anything that you see? Because, I mean, it sort of seems like, if anything, Tuor has a crappier childhood than Turin does. And yet he doesn't seem to turn out quite so badly as Turin. What do you make of that? Any thoughts? Laura, go ahead.
Well, we don't hear too much about it, really, other than he was, after he was orphaned, he was raised by the elves. We don't have much of a description of how he was raised, so I guess we have to infer from that it was pretty uneventful childhood. So
Yeah, I mean.
We just don't have a lot to go on. But it seems that Tuar is not quite as, his personality isn't as strong as Turin's, I guess I would say.
Yeah, that's certainly I think a safe thing to say, and actually, you know, Laura, just to comment on that, you know, that we just don't have all that much information. We're going to be confronted by that at many points. This chapter is incredibly short. I mean, obviously, it's not as short as some of these short chapters that we've seen before. I mean, it's fully, what, 7 pages? But, you know, this is a long story. And I think of all the places, we've commented at many points about how condensed these things are. I mean, there have been several times I remember, for instance, in the Dagor Bragalach chapter and everything, that we were saying, you know, gosh, this whole, there's so many of these paragraphs in there that could be a whole novel. You know, and we get this sense of long, heroic, and complex stories being surveyed for us in just a couple paragraphs. In this chapter, I find that to be rather extreme. That sense of compression. And, of course, that's assisted by the fact that this is one of the stories that Tolkien has written other versions of, and they're quite long. You know, this is one of the first of the Lost Tales that Tolkien wrote, back when he was in the Book of the Lost Tales version. This is one of the first things that he did when he came back from World War I and was recovering in the hospital from trench fever, which was a pretty long recovery process for him because he kept relapsing, fortunately, or else he would have been sent back to France. But anyway, one of the things that he was doing in hospital was writing the story of the fall of Gondolin. And the version that he wrote then is very, very long. Certainly long compared to this. We get quite a few details of his childhood and his escape from slavery and the time when he's wandering and his discovery of Vinyamar. A long description of the sort of carefully guarded and many gated entry into the Valley of Gondolin. The battle of the fall of Gondolin is the longest sustained description of a battle anywhere in Tolkien's corpus. We get full details. You want to see, combats in which lots of Balrogs are killed? I'd read the fall of Gondolin in the Book of Lost Tales. Balrogs are going down all over the place. There are dozens of Balrogs that attack the city, and many of them are killed. And we get, you know, long descriptions of the different sort of heraldic emblems of each of the houses of the Gondolindrim and who leads them and what their characters are. And it's quite long and quite rich and quite detailed. And so that certainly, if one is familiar with that at all, it's a bit of a shock to come to this shorter version. One of the reasons, of course, that I One of the reasons that I bring this up now is that I'm not going to want to talk about that too much. I mean, discussing the Book of Lost Tales version would be very interesting, but, you know, I'm not assuming everyone's read the Book of Lost Tales version, and, you know, I don't want to focus on that too much, especially if not all of us have read it. But I just wanted to kind of mention that in passing, because on a sort of generalized style time point, I think that the rapidity with which this chapter sort of sails over long epochs in Tuor's life and you know, major parts of the story, I think, are really interesting. I think that this is some very interesting choices, therefore, that Tolkien and Christopher together are making in working this out. But we were talking about comparing with Turin, and Joe, I think you wanted to make, before I digress there, I wanted to get that digression over with at the beginning here so I didn't have to launch into it later on. But Joe, go ahead.
All right. Am I good sound-wise?
Yes, you are. Very good.
All right. Now, it's interesting. Tuor lives a much more humble life than Turin. He even lives with the elves for the first part of his life, similar to Turin. But you don't hear a whole lot about him. And then, obviously the Grey Elves are not as grand as, the elves of Doriath. I mean, because there's a Maiar there. I mean, that just kind of overwhelms anything. And then, big turning point is instead of getting his freedom and doing what he wants to do, he ends up becoming a slave. And I mean, after that, it seems like that you can really tell that would define the two characters on the different paths, kind of. Not that they're both not great, but attitude-wise and the way they act, I mean, you can just see a totally different path being taken here. And I mean, it's almost that he seems more selfless, and that's difficult to say because, I mean, Torin was so great. I mean, he just kind of he had to lead, whether he liked to or not. At times, he should have stepped down, but that's besides the point. But Tuor just kind of being on his own, I mean, it really worked out for him.
Yeah, and it is interesting that, you know, if you just read that first paragraph, it really sounds like Tuor's childhood really was worse. He is, Joe, I think you make a really good point. Even the similarity does seem to point out a difference. That is, they're both taken to foster by Grey Elves as children, but yet, you know, you've got, on the one hand, Turin, who is taken in by Thingol and raised in the most splendid of all of the Grey Elves' dwellings in Middle-earth, and he is treated like the son of the king of Doriath. And Tuor is taken in by this random Grey Elf, who's never named again. We don't know anything about him, and is then held as a slave. It's not near. He doesn't have the kind of Turin had it good in comparison. Dave, go ahead.
I was wondering if you could, for us and the listeners, I was skimming through the text again as you were talking and looking at some of the locations that we mentioned, and some of them are ringing a bell, even though I don't quite remember what exactly they're. I remember them coming up later, like Vinyamar and Nevras and things like that. So maybe we could quickly review the important things that happened there. So we can connect the events of Tuor to the events of the past.
Yeah, it's a good idea, certainly, because the problem that we get here, the advantage that we have in reading the Silmarillion in the way that we have, which is slowly and carefully, has been that we've been able to really look very carefully at things as we go along. But it also means that things from early in the book are now a very, very long time ago. So I think that that's a good idea. We will recall, doubtless, that is, I should say, we will recall from our favorite chapter of Beleriand and its realms that when Turgon first settled down in Beleriand after his arrival, he built a city on the coast called Vinyamar. So Nevrast is the name of the land over by the coast, the kingdom, basically, the country that Turgon settled in. And he built his capital city, which was called Vinyamar. So Turgon built Vinyamar in Nevrast. Now, also remember, we were told at the time that one of the things which made Turgon's realm different from most of the other realms of the Noldor was the fact that more Grey Elves lived there than in any other kingdom of the Noldor, and in the land of Turgon did the blending of Noldor and Sindar happen most thoroughly. So we had Grey Elves and Noldor living in cooperation and in harmony in Nevrast with the capital city of Vinyamar. Then, of course, we remember, I don't doubt, the event of Olmo's warning, right? When Olmo appears in a dream to both Finrod and to Turgon on that day they were hanging out together and says, hey, why don't you guys build a secret fortress, a secret stronghold? And this leads Finrod ultimately to build Nargothrond, and it leads Turgon ultimately to build Gondolin, and he built Gondolin in secret, sneaking his, you know, workmen into Tumladen, into the valley inside the mountains there, and they build Gondolin, and then all of his people from Nevrast and Vinyamar slowly and secretly sneak across the continent and into Gondolin, and they close it up behind them, and they leave their city of Vinyamar empty on the coast. So no one has lived there ever since the Gondolindrim left. Now, you may also remember Olmo spoke again to Turgon and told him that he would someday send a messenger to him in Gondolin. and he gave specific instructions to Turgon. He said, leave a suit of armor here in Vinyamar. This is how you will know the messenger when he comes. This is how you will know he comes from me. He will be wearing this armor that you leave here. And Omo gave him specs. That is, he gave him instructions on exactly what size to build the armor so that Turgon, because that is, Omo knew who was going to come. So he gave him, Tuor's future body measurements so that he could make the armor that was designed for Tuor and to hang it there in Vinyamar. And then Tuor, of course, discovers it when he comes here to visit Vinyamar. Now, do you guys remember who Voronwë was? Tuor meets Voronwë. Do you recall him? That we did get a reference to him several chapters back. Laura, you recall?
Well, I don't recall exactly, but inferring from what we have here, wasn't he one of the ones that Turgon sent out in a ship to try to speak to the Valar and get some aid for the elves in Middle-earth?
Yes, exactly. This was one of the other little tidbits that we got about Turgon and Gondolin, kind of crammed around the details of the other stories that we've been looking at in the other chapters, and we've been kind of ignoring those until we got to now to sort of look at how what was going on with the Gondolindrim together. And yes, it was Turgon who was sending his mariners down the River Sirion in secrecy, and then they were setting forth from down near the Isle of Balar, and they were trying to get back across to Valinor to ask for help and pardon of the Valar. Now, recall, again, when we talked about Turgon way back, about especially that moment with Turgon and Finrod, one of the things we were emphasizing there was that those two, Turgon and Finrod, were sort of the most westerly facing of all the elves. Of all of the captains of the Noldor, they were the ones who seemed to be most oriented back towards Valinor, whether it be in small things, like, for instance, the detail that Finrod brought with him more treasures out of Valinor than any of the other Noldoran princes, or whether it is the way that Gondolin is set up. Recall that Gondolin built on its little its little hill, makes it sound a little too cute, built on its hill in the valley was a memory of Elven Tirion, and we were sort of seeing the ways in which Turgon was dedicating this place, was really thinking back to their home in Valinor, and he built those replicas of the two trees, the silver tree and the gold tree, to recall the trees of Valinor. So, we could see the ways in which he was thinking about Valinor. Both of them were thinking, but especially Turgon. And then he was the only one who was thinking, okay, hey, maybe we should head back towards Valinor and see if the Valar will actually help us. And Voronwë was on the last shipload of mariners that Turgon sent back into the West. So that's Voronwë's story, and I think it's really important for us to remember the context of that. That is, the context that Voronwë had been sent as a messenger to the Valar, and so when you sort of think about the story from Voronwë's standpoint, it's kind of interesting. But Laura, you had a question about sort of Tuor and his relationship with Olmo here and Voronwë. Just wanted to give you a chance to ask that. I think it's a really interesting question. Are you there, Laura?
I am, and I'm trying to remember my question.
It was just about...
Tuor, I mean, is he just picked to be the instrument of Olmo? Was he just picked at random? Or, it's just not clear why Tuor is picked, you could see somebody like Baron or somebody like Turin, who has this real strong, forceful personality, but Tuor just seems to be, pretty level-headed guy, actually, so I was just curious why Olmo would have picked him.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily, in that form, in some ways, it's sort of impossible to answer that. That is, what was it about Tuor Well, we don't know, but what we do know is he is selected in advance. You know, if there are any of the stories in the Silmarillion thus far which really consistently bring up the issue of prophecy and destiny, it's this one. Remember that this story has its... I was going to say this story has its germ in a prophecy. That's not quite the right way to say it. The role of Tuor's character does. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, well, the other thing I was thinking is, you know, his father is the brother of Húrin, and maybe it's more of a family thing, you know, this whole family is fated, you know, for good or ill. Maybe it's the relation there that's important.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that we can kind of connect this back to the first part of the discussion that we were having, that is the comparison between Tuor and Túrin. And both of them have strong dooms laid upon them. Túrin's is a horrible doom. Tuor's is not like a pleasant, cheerful, happy doom, but he is doomed. He is destined to be an agent of deliverance. It all starts with Huor's prophecy to Turgon in the Nirnaeth Arnoidead when Huor and Húrin say they're going to cover the retreat of the Gondolindrim. I would just recall this on page 194. Huor spoke and said, "Yet if it's this, referring to Gondolin, yet if it stands but a little while, then out of your house shall come the hope of elves and men. This I say to you, Lord, with the eyes of death, though we part here forever, and I shall not look on your white walls again. From you and from me a new star shall arise. Farewell." So that's one prophecy. The other prophecy, of course, again, was Olmo's own prophecy. "There shall come one who shall come to the halls of Vinyamar, and he shall find this armor that you make, and here is what he will look like, and he will come to you with a message." From every side, Tuor has this, you know, there's literally this this story that he's supposed to step into. I mean, he's got this armor sitting there designed for him. Chris, go ahead.
I guess I wanted to say that somebody mentioned about the forceful personalities or something to that effect. I don't know that I'm thinking that maybe he got picked or whatever, maybe because I don't think he had a weak personality. He just wasn't an overbearing jerk like maybe his cousin was. And maybe the way he grew up in the caves and then in slavery, he grew up with a little bit more humility. And so I don't know that translates into a softer personality.
Right.
Jordan, I'm sure it's there.
Right.
So that's... I got to ignore the chat while I'm speaking.
Yes, that's kind of crucial, especially when Jordan is chatting. Yeah, yeah.
But I guess to the extent that somebody saw in advance of what type of man he was going to be, as it turns out, he's a great leader too, but I guess maybe the humility that he has he didn't have an easy upbringing, but it generated humility, while Túrin had a great upbringing and a splendid place, and he had issues.
Yeah, you know, and I think it is really fascinating in that way. I mean, on the one hand, you can say, again, looking at Tuor's whole career, that he is possibly even more than Túrin, the victim of destiny. Again, it's a different destiny. It's a different doom that he faces, but it still is, there is a strong doom upon him. He has, even again, with Túrin, we don't see from the beginning that there's a path laid out for him. At no point does the text suggest, well, at this certain point, Túrin is going to come to this location, and when he comes here, he is going to do this. You know, we know that a general doom of, you know, suffering is laid upon him, and that what he turns his hand to will turn to evil, but not with the specificity, not with the sort of the clear destiny. He's going to come here to this place, and when he does this, then it's going to be laid upon him to perform this task. And yet, so although it seems in these ways, as I say, Tuor is even more a sort of a plaything of destiny, I think, Chris, you're right that we can see he seems to be making choices in his life which are different from Turin's, that he seems to be not necessarily just passively going along with it. And I think one of the things briefly that I would point to here is the moment with the swans. Let's see. Yes, the bottom of page 238. Then he dwelt in Nevrast alone, and the summer of that year passed. Tuor has spent, apart from the time when he was being fostered, he has been alone most of his life. So living in solitude, that's what Tuor does. Then he dwelt in Nevrast alone, and the summer of that year passed, and the doom of Nargothrond drew near. That is, his cousin was down south causing havoc. But when the autumn came, he saw seven great swans flying south, and he knew them for a sign that he had tarried over long, and he followed their flight along the shores of the sea. Now, think about the way in which that one sentence shows these combination of things. That on the one hand, it's like he himself knows that his life is being controlled by destiny. He knew them for a sign that he had tarried over long. I am not following the path that I am supposed to follow. And yet, he's the one who's choosing. He's the one who follows their flight and realizes, I should not be just hanging out here. I should be going to do something. And he goes. But anyway, okay, there's a long queue now. Dave, go ahead.
So I have a question about the turn of phrase that is used here, where it says that Olmo, let's see, where the heck is it? I'm looking for it. There we go. Olmo said it in his heart to depart from the land of his fathers, for he had chosen Tuor as the instrument of his designs. That's wording seems sort of, and perhaps this is just my fuzzy memory from lack of sleep over the weekend about the rest of the book, but that turn of phrase seems to be quite different from the kind of language that we have. I'm wondering if perhaps the story was written at a different time, or this version of the story was written at a different time from, for example, the Turin Turambar story we just read in other parts. But that seems like an unusually, it sounds very sort of contemporary Christian type of thing to say, the idea of a deity setting something in your heart and planting a feeling in you. And, it's a very strange sort of direct intervention by one of the Valar. Not just simply, in some cases, Ulmo appearing to people in dreams and saying, hey, you should go do this. But in this case, he actually puts a feeling or a desire in Tuor's heart. That's a much more direct intervention. It's not simply going and saying, hey, you should go do this. He actually went into his heart and gave him a desire that probably started him down this path. And I'm just wondering, that strikes me as very different from the picture of the Valar's interactions with people throughout the rest of the book. And so I was just wondering if you could talk
about that. No, I agree. And I don't think that it's just a stylistic thing either. This is just that's the first of the many examples in this story where especially Olmo, this is like Olmo's story here. Olmo is a major player in this story. We haven't seen one of the Valar be a major player other than Morgoth in any of these chapters for a long time. Olmo is all over this chapter, and he is all over Tuor's career. And again, that's what I think. And as far as the laying it upon his heart, we do see him basically manipulating the feelings, as you say, of Tuor. But this isn't the only time. There is another time when he lays something upon his heart. That is, it's not that it uses that exact same phrase, but that is his Tuor's relationship with the sea.
Mm-hmm.
An unquiet was on him that took him at last into the depths of the realms of Olmo.
Right.
Let's see. Looking upon Beleagar, the great sea, he was enamored of it, and the sound of it and the longing for it were ever in his heart and ear, and an unquiet was on him that took him at last into the depths of the realms of Olmo. So not only does he lay it in his heart to start his trip, to depart from the land of his fathers, set it in his heart to depart from the land of his fathers. Who does that sound like, Jason? Does that remind you of anybody you wrote a paper about recently? I don't know if you have your microphone honored or not tonight, Jason, but of course, that's like, again, thinking, thinking, Dave, of what you were just saying about Christian things, that there is a biblical parallel. That's like Abraham leaving the land of his fathers. So Olmo is.
So what I'm wondering is, What I'm wondering is, after coming away from MythCon, especially Verlyn Flieger's talk, where she really delves into Tolkien's development as a storyteller over the course of his life, it just gets me wondering, why does this seem so different from other parts of the Silmarillion, where the Valar and even Ulmo are not directly intervening this way? Is it this particular story? Is it this point in history? Or could it be that Tolkien, this version of this story, Tolkien was writing at a different point in his life when he was taking things, you know, when he had changed his picture of the metaphysics of Arda and the relationship of the Valar and that kind of stuff. So I'm wondering if that could be an element here.
Sort of, though. I mean, I think that those elements of this story, though, are there from the beginning. Like, I certainly don't think it's a question of, and this is a hard thing to do with the Silmarillion anyway, because...
Well, that's what I was wondering, you know, I mean...
Yeah, it's not like it's linear.
It may be dangerous to try and string the different, you know, each of the chapters together, because they weren't written to be a continuous book, right? They weren't written in isolation. He had maybe the entire mythology in mind as he wrote it, but by no means did he sit down and write one chapter after another. He wrote them separately, and it's, you know, it may not even be necessarily safe to assume that he always had a consistent single monolithic picture of how Arda functions as he wrote each story. It could be that he changes his mind as he writes them about the, you know, maybe fundamental structures and stuff.
Right.
I don't know. I've been inspired to wonder these things after MythCon.
Yeah. No, it's true. Especially since, as you say, you know, there are differences. None of these stories are not necessarily in the same state, and we do have to recall, as you say, Dave, that the Silmarillion as a collection of, you know, as a work, doesn't really exactly exist. That it's this volume, this book that we're holding, was put together by Tolkien and by his son Christopher, based upon all of the multiple versions of these stories that Tolkien had written throughout his life, and they didn't always choose the same versions. That is, sometimes earlier versions of things stuck, sometimes later versions of things stuck, sometimes they have to kind of combine things together and fill gaps that are there. It's complicated. But at the same time, I don't think that that necessarily explains this. That is, this is a moment, and this, I think, really was always a moment, even in the, you know, in the early version of the stories and the later version of the stories, this is always a moment where the Valar intervene, or at least where a Vala intervenes, that is Ulmo. And that is a choice that I think is fairly consistent. And I don't think that we can say, well, there's, you know, the Ulmo's all over this and he wasn't before, and so that's evidence that, you know, Tolkien is just thinking about the relationship between the Valar and Middle-earth totally, you know, quite differently in this chapter than he was in other chapters. There might be some ways in which that's true, but I don't think that that's an explanation for this. We've seen Ulmo intervening before, especially with Turgon. And so not only is Turgon the most, you know, sort of westward-oriented of all of them, also he's the one who's been receiving assistance from Ulmo and messages from Ulmo. And we see that, obviously, most emphatically here. So, yeah, it's difficult, but I think that we still can see I think that it's still okay for us to read this from within a kind of continuity of it, and I think that you can see that, you know, one of the ways in which this story has been changed in its extreme shortening from other versions is that it's still being deliberately kept consistent with the others, with the other chapters that we've seen, certainly being kept consistent by Christopher. But several of you have been very patient. Joe, go ahead.
All right. You sort of covered this earlier. This is more upon like a free will and predestination. You just see like a wonderful mix of it here. Even going back to where Ulmo had Turgon make the armor, I mean, because it's like they knew, like, through events that, you know, the elves would not win the Nunaeth and Nuadiad. I mean, just he knew that wasn't going to happen, and like you said, he knew Tuor was going to be there, but just, you pointed out examples in both Tuor and Turin's life of free will. I mean, mm-hmm. you just see this awesome mix of predestination and free will where these choices come in, and then again, like, there is a path going on here that something is going to happen, and you kind of know it because nothing can be done without the Valor, like we pointed out before, which is pointed out again by the armor. You just see it work so well, and it's put together so well here. I mean, it's like a perfect example to look at if you're ever really confused about how it works in Tolkien.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. And I think that with Tuor, he is going to have choices. And Turgon is going to have, I think, choices. But yet, throughout this story, you have this this destiny. And Tuor isn't the only one who has this sort of thing laid on his heart. Remember, Idril is going to have a similar kind of experience later on in the story. But let's not jump ahead too much here. Jack, go ahead.
Yeah, getting back to Tuor, the conversation's kind of moved on, but I'll try to tie it in. His personality, does he have a weak personality? I don't think so, because, you know, it says, you know, he was mighty in stature and in mind, and clearly he was beloved by almost everybody. So this is clearly somebody that doesn't have a weak personality. Mm-hmm. However, is it unfair to say that maybe he's a little boring?
Tuor?
Not quite a three-dimensional character, and could that also account for why he's not developed as much compared to, say, Turin, and not given the same page count? He's just too good. He's not interesting.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he certainly is not. We don't get the kind of complexity that we get with Turin, and I think that's fair. I mean, again, on the one hand, I have a hard time, because this is so much shorter a version of his story than Turin, given how quickly we're going through all of these events of his life, it would be hard to get close to Tuor here and to really kind of see the inner workings of his mind in the ways that we do get to with Turin, for better or for worse. But there's no question, you're absolutely right, that the character of Turin, I find a really compelling one. And even when he was, you know, annoying us at various times with the choices that he makes, he is still certainly, as you say, an interesting and rounded character. We can see his motivations. We can understand where he's coming from. We can see how all of these different factors within him and his background and his choices are all working together. And with Turin, we don't really get that, and that's true. I think part of that is a reflection of the brevity of the story, but I don't think all of it is. I mean, I think, you know, Jack, in part, you are right. He is the vehicle of destiny, and it's not really about him. Turin's story, in as much as he is, you know, although he still talks like and feels like he is a helpless victim, or he's determined not to be a helpless victim, instead he's going to go around victimizing everybody else. But nevertheless, he is the centerpiece. He and his personality are the centerpiece of the story. Tuor is not in anything like the centerpiece of his story, even though the chapter title would lead us to believe otherwise, of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin. Yet in a sense, you could say this story isn't really all that interested in Tuor for most of the time. Not personally, Jack, in the way that you were describing, that we do get with Turin. Instead, it's about what he accomplishes and what he does, and what is done through him. And he is the instrument. He is almost instrument in that story. But Chris, go ahead. I know you were wanting to talk about something. I think about Tuor's early career. Is that right?
Well, this is just a very, very quick comment. And other characters in the story that we've seen who spent a lot of time alone, like Melkor and Fëanor and Éowyn, that seems to be a huge negative, whether cause or effect, of their personality. With Tuor, I thought it was interesting that that negative consequence didn't come out from spending huge amounts of time alone. Not terribly important, but just I thought that was an interesting difference.
I agree. I think it's a really good point, because it is, it is remarkable that Tuor does spend all that time alone, and yet not only does he not fall into that same pattern, he's almost the opposite of the pattern that we see. Solitariness has tended to be associated with pride. Those who separate themselves from other people, as you said, like Aeol, like Melkor, even like Feanor, these people who separate themselves away are tend to be doing it because they are, because they're thinking of themselves, because they are, they're kind of turning inwards in ways that other people are not. And that's a bad thing. Aeol is clearly doing that. Melkor is clearly doing that at the beginning. But remember, and pay attention here, guys, there's a pop quiz for you. Who else have we seen, what other majorly important figure in the Silmarillion have we seen who seeks solitariness, who separates himself from others, and yet is not marked by pride, but rather by humility? Jason's got it, I think. Meme, says Jordan. No, not meme. Not meme. Mike says, Nianna, to some extent, though she doesn't exactly separate herself. We get her own halls and things, but she is also still associated with her brothers, the Feanturi, with Mandos and Lorien. I was thinking with Jason, Olmo. And at the time when we were looking at that, we were talking about how sort of unusual that seemed, that when Olmo separates himself, he's the only one of the major figures in the Valar who doesn't even live in Valinor. He doesn't hang out with him at all. He holds himself aloof and is this sort of secretive and solitary character. And it's not just that he lives alone, because we learn that he acts alone too. That is, he does not follow the counsel of the rest of the Valar. He does not, he just doesn't play along. He disagrees with them. He acts independently of them. And yet, this isn't a sign of evil in him. This isn't a sign of pride in him, it seems. At least, and we were noticing how strange that seemed at the time. And yet it's an interesting parallel to notice here, isn't it? That the agent of Olmo, the instrument of Olmo, is following a very similar pattern in his life. He, too, is living alone. For most of his life, he's living alone, other than that time of fosterage. And we're not even just talking about, without companions. Turin was rarely without companion. He usually had Beleg or Gwyndor or somebody. And yet, here is Tuor living in the wilderness like a hermit, like an outlaw. Well, he is an outlaw, not just like an outlaw. And yet, his response to that is not pride, but like Olmo, it's humility. And I think it's very interesting. But Chris, I think that I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is a very noteworthy thing, I think, about Tuor's career. We've been kind of jumping around a little bit, but let's move up to Gondolin. I should mention, this was another thing that was kind of skipped over in the short version of the story here, but it's one detail that I said we weren't going to talk about the Book of Lost Tales, and I won't go into too much detail, but I will just mention the fact that, that one brief encounter with Turin, but even as they gazed upon it, that is the pools of Ivrin, they saw one going northward in haste, and he was a tall man clad in black and bearing a black sword. But they knew not who he was, nor anything of what had befallen in the south, and he passed them by, and they said no word. Now, here is the moment, the one moment, when the actual careers of Tuor and Turin cross. Of course, we should recognize Turin here. He's got his black sword here. Tuor actually lays eyes on Turin from a distance, and their paths literally cross each other here at this moment. They're going in different directions, and they're doing different things. Now, this seems to me, I cannot help but think, a very clear and open invitation to do some comparison and contrast, so I am keen not to resist that opportunity. First, recall, where are they? Where is Turin going? when we...
He's going to hit them, isn't he?
Yes, he
save
is.
His parent, his family?
Right, or he thinks he's going to see them. But yes, exactly. So he is going up and more of the circumstances of that. What should we recall about this trip north by Turin?
Orion kind of sent him. He should have gone after whatever that elf one's name is.
Finduilas, yes.
Yes, he should have been going after her, but he wasn't. So he kind of... This is when he was clearly going on the path towards his destruction, really.
Yes.
Kind of like... that's where he clearly chose to where he kind of screwed up, and then he finds the Pools of Ivrin where they're standing later, and they're frozen up.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and that was before that, actually. I don't remember when that was, but you get my point.
Yes.
This is the result of Glaurung's lies, right?
Exactly. Why is Turin going? Well, you know... One way we could put it is to say that Glaurung has laid it on Turin's heart to go to Hithlum, and he's going. Now, he is being manipulated for evil, while Tuor is being manipulated for good. But there is an interesting, well, sort of a parallel, sort of an anti-parallel there between the two of them. Joe, exactly the terms that you are using there, I think, are really important. This is the moment, as we discussed before, this seems to be the moment in Turin's life where it is officially over. His destiny is coming upon him now. We are told, if we are to believe Gwyndor's prophecy in Nargothrond, if he goes and saves Finduilas' life, he might possibly still avoid his destiny. But having instead listened to Glaurung and been deceived by Glaurung's lies and now headed up to Hithlum, which is where Tuor meets him, or sees him anyway, now his doom is sealed. Tuor, going in the other direction, not exactly opposite, but, you know, coming, crossing his path at 90 degrees, is also... in the moment of fulfilling his destiny. This trip that Tuor is taking is also the trip of his destiny. And we saw him sort of delaying his destiny. And, you know, in other longer versions of the story, Tolkien emphasizes even more the kind of... I don't want to say lounging around is not quite right, but that sentence that I read about his realizing that he had stayed over long, and then the swans come and he knows it for a sign that he's supposed to get the heck out of there and get moving and stop just kicking around Nevrast in the way that he was. He needed to go and embrace his destiny, and he did. And now he is on the trip, which is sealing his fate, which is going to bring about the fulfillment of his destiny. Just as Turin is on the way to fulfill his horrible destiny. Laura, go ahead.
I was away for a little bit, so I apologize if somebody already said this, but you know, with all these elves especially, and even Turin, not listening to the Valar, you know, Tuor really makes himself stand out by actually listening to one of the Valar and actually, you know, seeing the signs and not just saying, you know, I don't need to follow those silly signs, you know.
Right.
He's the only one who's really open to being guided by the Valar.
Yeah. And he is guided by the Valar. And again, Almo is all over this story. You know, he didn't just lay it on his heart in the beginning, and he doesn't just lead him into Vinyamar, and doesn't just appear to him in person and speak to Tuor. I mean, we haven't seen that. Even Turgon didn't get Almo appearing to him in person. We kind of skipped over that moment, but that's a really important moment. There came a great storm out of the west, the top of page 239. And out of that storm, Olmo, the Lord of Waters, arose in majesty and spoke to Tuor as he stood beside the sea. And Olmo bade him depart from that place and seek out the hidden kingdom of Gondolin, and he gave Tuor a great cloak to mantle him in shadow from the eyes of his enemies. So even the whole path of Tuor, he is concealed by Olmo. And just in case we've forgotten that, we're reminded of that the paragraph after, you know, two paragraphs down the page. And at last, by the power of Olmo set upon them, they came to the hidden door of Gondolin. At every step along the way, Tuor is with Olmo. Laura, go ahead.
I just was wondering if Olmo had actually appeared to Turin, do you think he would have listened to him?
I think it would be hard for anyone to ignore Olmo appearing in Majesty, but I mean you are right to be reminding us that it's not just that one of them is sort of responsive to the Valar and the other is not. We're talking, both of them receive messages from Olmo, and Turin disregards his message. Well, okay, no, see, hang on, I'm being sloppy. If we were at MythCon, Vroen Fligger would be smacking me down right now. Turin is not the one who receives the message from Olmo. Orodreth, remember, receives the message from Olmo, though we talked about the sort of, I think, pointedly ambivalent phrasing there, that the message comes to the Lord of Nargothrond, which should be Orodreth, but in practice is actually Turin. But anyway, Tuor, unquestionably, does personally receive this message from Olmo. But Laura, again, you're right. We can see that they're in a completely different place. Turin, where was Olmo appearing in person? Where was Olmo laying it on Turin's heart? We didn't see that. But, you know, it's possible to think about this in a different way. That is, we didn't see this before, perhaps in part because Turin is the one who's responding. Has Olmo ever laid anything on anybody else's heart to do? And they just ignored then, and they didn't do it, and they refused to do it. But you know, that I think is possible. We see that happen. You know, we see them being disregarded at various other points. Tuor's story unfolds the way that it does. You know, with the power of Olmo set upon him and all that, in part because he obeys and does what he's supposed to do. Laura?
Yeah, I was just thinking. You know, if it was Turin, he would be obviously overwhelmed at the time, but you can see, or you can imagine that he might try to subvert Olmo's wishes to his own. You know, that his ego would kind of get in the way, where it doesn't happen with Tuor.
Yeah. No, and again, I think that's where we can see certainly Tuor is. You know, and Jordan gave his excellent paper on pride at MythCon, and I think in Tuor we see one of the queerest examples of the contrary. Tuor is a humble character. Compared to Turin, but who isn't really compared to Turin? I guess Feanor is probably more proud than Turin is, but Tuor, I think. In Tuor, we do get an example of a genuinely humble character. And one of the ways in which we see that humility manifested is in basically his submission. He goes along. He does what he's told. He is obedient. And, you know, and Jack, I come back to the point that you made before. Submission and obedience doesn't make for a really fiery and interesting character. It is because his own personality is not at the center of his actions that he ends up doing so well. But that does make him sort of a less interesting character to think about and to read about. Joe?
I was going to talk about how Olmo actually did kind of... He didn't really put anything in Turin's heart, but he cleansed Turin of the pools of Ivrin. I mean, he did work in him. It mentions, you know, the waters of Olmo cleansing him of that, and I don't remember if it really said I don't think he really spoke to him or anything like that, but I mean, he gave him the chance to really realize, hey, I'm trying to help you out here, I'm trying to help you do these good things. I mean, I just kind of healed you of your insanity for killing your best friend. I mean,
yes,
let me help you out. And then, I mean, you know, he comes back to him later, like, hey, it's me again, you should stop doing this, and, you know, that's Turin's pride, kind of like, eh, no thanks.
Yes, no, yeah. Yeah, Turin's response is like, it's okay, I got this, right? I Nargothrond, you're telling me how to defend Nargothrond? Please, you know, I've got this. I've got myself a good army. You know, have you seen me fight? Please, you know, I got this. But, Joe, I mean, that's a fantastic point, and I know you were really great on the Pools of Ivrin when we were doing the Turin story, and you were right to remember that, especially since, of course, we're given a reminder of it here in Turin's story, because that's near the place where the two of them cross paths. And, you know, you could say, in a sense, that you know, you could look at the Pools of Ivrin as itself kind of emblematic of the divergence in the paths of the careers of Tuor and Turin. That is, their two responses to it. Joe, as you say, Turin has the opportunity, but he leaves it behind, goes off to Nargothrond, and then starts openly defying Ulmo, whereas Tuor has his encounter with Ulmo and submits. But let's go on to his reception in Gondolin, because pretty soon Dave is going to start demanding another week if we're not careful here. Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, just wanted to comment on, I found it interesting how Turgon abandons Ulmo's call for the end. I mean, he listens to him at first, and Ulmo directs him to find him in building Gondolin. He listens to his call to flee the battle in order to keep Gondolin safe. And then he hesitates to let Hurin in after he leaves Angband, and then finally he ignores Ulmo's call in the end. He even recalls being told, "Love not too well the work of thy hands and thy heart." And it simply says he became prideful. He was proud. It's not the first time Ulmo, obviously, has been ignored. It happens. He had fallen out of
Yeah. Yeah.
But you think he would, have built up some sort of trust in Ulmo.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really great point. You know, I mean, as you say, disregarding the Valar and Ulmo in particular is old hat at this point. I mean, it's cliche, everybody's doing it. But I think you're absolutely right. With Turgon, it is the most inexcusable of anybody. Turgon is the one who has had this positive relationship. He's the one, he's been following Ulmo's guidance all along. And as you say, we are reminded, you know, it's the one thing that is explicitly re-quoted, that is the warning that Ulmo gave him before. Love not too well the work of thy hands and the devices of thy heart, and remember that the true hope of the Noldor lieth in the west and cometh from the sea. Ulmo says that to him in Vinyamar, in preparation for this moment. And this is the message that Tuor has been sent to give him. And it's not like there's skepticism here. It would be one thing if Tuor comes to Turgon and Turgon's response is, "Oh, I don't think you are really from Ulmo. You are some kind of imposter. This is a lie of Morgoth." Because, you know what? That's perfectly plausible. You could totally see that. But that isn't it. And he knows it's not it because he knows he's wearing the armor that, in some versions of the story, Turgon himself made and left in Vinyamar. There is no doubt in Turgon's mind that this dude was sent by Ulmo to him. So that... go ahead.
This also seems to be sort of out of character for Turgon. Like, he's the one who's most turning to the west and sending ships out. Like, he remembers the last half of the warning, but then ignores the first half. It just seems such a bizarre character change for him.
Yeah, yeah. But we have seen, as Nick was reminding us, we have seen a bit of a progression in Turgon. And, you know, we saw that on the one hand, he went to Gondolin and he closed it up. He came out, that is, he and his whole army came out to the Nirnaeth Arnoidead. So although they were still a secret place and they were still keeping to themselves, they were willing to march out in force to join in at the great battle and not to abandon their kinsmen. Then they go in and they say, "We're never coming out again." And so now, like, okay, that policy has changed. You know, never again are we going to march out to battle. So now that's different. And then remember the passage that we looked at last time briefly, when Hurin comes out and is yelling to him, and Turgon says in that passage that we emphasized, "My heart is shut, but it's only shut briefly," and then he opens tries to open his heart again and go get him, but it's already too late. But now we see the policy of the Gondolinjerim has since changed more. Right below that, this is on page 240, where those words are recalled, and we're told that he has become proud. You could see, okay, let's actually just start from that sentence. So from five lines in of that second paragraph. "But Turgon was become proud, and Gondolin as beautiful as a memory of Elven Tirion, and he trusted still in its secret and impregnable strength, though even a Vala should gainsay it. And after the Nirnaeth Arnoidead, the people of that city desired never again to mingle in the woes of elves and men, without, nor to return through dread and danger into the west. Shut behind their pathless and enchanted hills, they suffered none to enter, though he fled from Morgoth hate pursued, and tidings of the lands beyond came to them faint and far, and they heeded them little. So we see it's like the heart of all of the Gondolindrum is shut now. I mean, that sentence is sort of sad, you know, that they suffered none to enter, though he fled from Morgoth hate pursued. That's tough. Dave?
Well, I was just going to add that he is, his pride and trust in the secret of Gondolin, you know, they say that even though a Valar should gainsay it, but it's not just the gainsay of a Valar, it's also against evidence in past history where people have found the city and then gone back out again. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost absurd that he thinks it's still a secret at this point.
Right.
It's like, well, nobody knows where it is. Well, except for those one guys. But we won't worry about them. You know, and the other... So, if I recall correctly from Turin Turambar, Thorondor brings him news of Húrin, standing in the wilderness, near where Gondolin is, shouting, "Hey, Turgon, can't you hear me?" And he doesn't think that Morgoth, you know, was following him and can put two and two together. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, this is a point that that my students often make when I'm teaching the Silmarillion, is like, doesn't he think that eventually Morgoth is going to figure out by process of elimination the general region where Gondolin is? I mean, like, when you look at the map,
that's
there,
right.
There aren't that many places where
it's the
be.
One place where when his orcs go in there, eagles keep swooping down and killing them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, I mean, sure, Húrin reveals to him the region, but again, how hard was that? No, I mean, that's easy to say, but yes, I agree. It is vain. It is obviously vain. It is transparently vain to just trust in the secrecy of Gondolin. And especially, of course, it's pointedly ironic when he says, "Lest a Valar should gainsay it." And, you know, maybe we, you know, are remembering somebody like Fëanor there, who set himself up against a Valar, that is, against Morgoth himself, and believed that he could take down a Valar, believed that he could overcome, you know, one of the mightiest creature in all of, you know, creation, at least originally. And we saw that was kind of a silly belief in the end. From the beginning, it was a silly belief. But here, this is not... No matter, even if Morgoth himself comes, we will be able to keep our place impregnable. That's not what he's saying there. Morgoth is not the Valar in question. Olmo is the Valar in question. He is saying, Olmo the Valar has sent me a message and said, "Get out. Gondolin is going to fall soon. Leave Gondolin behind." And so he says, he trusted still to its secret and impregnable strength, though even a Valar should gainsay it. Not even though even a Valar should come against it, though even a Valar should gainsay it. So even if Olmo says it's going to fall, I think Olmo's wrong, because Gondolin is that strong. And it's the more pointedly ironic. On what does he base his confidence in the secrecy of Gondolin? In the Valar, in the eagles of Manway, and in the secret of Olmo. He built Gondolin in obedience to Olmo's words. Olmo was the one who said, "Hey, great idea. I've got a great idea. Build this city. Take your people." He appears to him in the dream. He appears to him in Vinyamar. He gets instructions. He's doing this under the instructions of Olmo. When the dude who instructed him to build this in order to be safe says, "Okay, the time has come. Told you it was going to come. Now is the time. Here's my messenger dressed in the armor that I told you to leave for him. Now go." For at that point, Turgon to say, "But what the heck does Olmo know, really, please? You know, I mean, I so know better than he." Crazy. This is, I think, although we don't get the kind of build-up with Turgon, we don't get the kinds of sort of career trajectories of pride leading to destruction that, you know, Jordan in his paper was pointing out about Thingol and Fëanor, this one moment is, I think, one of the most almost sort of ludicrous instances of pride that we see in the whole Quenta. Joe?
All right, this is kind of moving on to a different topic. Is
Great,
there anything else
fine.
Anybody wants to say about that? Or
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll move on. Now, this is kind of getting back to the character of Tuor. You see his character really paying off here, like him being humble. I mean, it says he remained in Gondolin, and he became mighty in stature and in mind. I mean, he basically almost, maybe not quite, but grew up to the stature of Turin. And, I mean, he learned about the lore, and then the king's daughter wants to be with him, and Turgon's like, sure, go ahead. And he marries the elf that Turin missed and let get killed. I mean, like, gets speared through a tree. I mean, he gets blessed with that, kind of. And you see kind of just how the humbleness of him and him not focusing on himself more so is paying off for him, and really just his path is really working out, leading towards his future.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think, you know, Joe, that's a great point, and you can see the irony there, right? For Turin, the elf maiden who loved him was his possible way out of his destiny. And when he did not get together with the elf maiden, when he basically chose not to be Baron to her Luthien, that's when his career was done. That was the final tipping point of his career. With Tuor, it's like it works backwards, right? Having done the right thing, having achieved his good destiny and been humble and submitted to his destiny, the consequence of that is the elf maiden. She's not the instrument. She is. It's not exactly like the reward, though, because this, of course, even see what I just said is not quite right. It's not that she is the instrument of his destiny, because it turns out, of course, that being Olmo's messenger is not the fulfillment of his destiny, it's the setup for his destiny. You know, and that Olmo has much more in mind than just, I think I'm going to send this dude to Gondolin and he's going to be my chosen messenger. You know, I needed somebody, and so here we go, it's going to be this guy. When he gets to Gondolin, yes, he delivers Olmo's message, but what he's really going to Gondolin for, what his real role is to marry Idril and be the father of Eärendil, as we saw in his dad's, in Huor's prophecy. From you and from me a new star shall arise. And Turgon remembers that. And Turgon realizes, and that, again, is sort of the final irony, sort of the final, you know, I hate to say it, but the final stupidity of Turgon's choice to reject the teaching of Olmo here, the message of Olmo, is that he still treats Tuor. He realizes that Tuor is bound up with the fate of Gondolin. He realizes that Tuor is important. So I know that he's really sent by Olmo. He is obviously an agent of destiny for Gondolin, so I'm going to show favor to him. I'm going to listen to, like, everything else that he says. I'm going to allow him to become one of my central counselors. I'm going to let him become my son-in-law and marry my daughter, become the second human being ever to marry an elf woman. But, you know, I'm just, like, whatever, I'm going to ignore Olmo's message that he's bringing, but, you know, the rest of that I'm going to take into account. That's crazy. Now, Jack, I want to come back to the point that you made in our class notes, because I think that that's a really fantastic point. That is, we get three human beings, three human men who marry elven women. Baron, now Tuor, and later on we'll get Aragorn. And Jack, you were sort of talking about how Tuor seems to be in a really different category from either Aragorn or Baron in that way. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I just find it almost humorous, like you say, of the three men that marry elves, Aragorn and Baron, they have to go through hell to achieve that honor.
Yes.
Aragorn has to become the king of not one kingdom, but two. High King, unite two kingdoms, and Baron has to go off and get a Silmaril out of the very iron crown of Morgoth. Just two almost impossible things. But when it comes to Tuor, Turgon just practically, like, picks up his daughter and puts him in Tuor's arms.
Yeah, yeah. No, and you know, that's a great point. Brief semi-digressional point about Aragorn there, because I think that parallel, you know, when you look at that parallel in that way, it is really interesting. One might be tempted when one looks at the story of Aragorn and Arwen as it is told in Appendix A of The Return of the King. One might be tempted to see Elrond as, you know, I mean, he is in the, and he knows that he is in the role of Thingol there, right? That, you know, that there's this mortal man who is in love with his daughter and wants to marry his daughter. He knows how this works. But there's a big difference in what the conditions that Elrond places upon Aragorn's marrying Arwen and the conditions that Thingol lays upon Beren's marrying of Lúthien. You're right, Jack, that it is in many ways a parallel task. I mean, essentially what Aragorn is told is, okay, if you manage to overthrow Sauron and unite the north and south kingdoms of ancient Gondor again, then you can marry my daughter. But unlike with Thingol, this is not him just trying to throw a huge, you know, theoretically insurmountable obstacle in the path. Instead, you know, Jack, I think the way that you put your observation, the way that you put your initial point, I think is really good, and I think that we can kind of see Elrond looking at it in this way. That is, look, this is how it's supposed to work. This kind of thing doesn't just happen. If you are going to be, you know, you don't just waltz up and marry an elf woman. It happens through suffering. You know, it is part of a larger story. And so, you know, it's like Elrond knows the script. He knows how this is supposed to work. If you are going to marry my daughter Arwen, that moment can only happen if it is the culmination of your long and heroic story. So you have to go through the darkness. You have to go through the suffering. You have to go through this very painful and extremely difficult task in order to get there. Because only at that point is it going to be what it should be. Only at that point is it going to be, fitting? Is it going to be right? And so I agree with Jack that Tuor's marriage of Idril seems different. Not quite anticlimactic, but certainly compared to Beren and Aragorn's careers, he has made good choices. It's not like to say that he hasn't accomplished anything. But all he did was come to Gondolin and deliver a message. And again, I think this is a place where we can see him as the instrument of destiny. But Laura, go ahead.
I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but, you know, also we find out at the end of the chapter that Tuor actually becomes an elf. He becomes counted with the Eldar.
Yes.
And, you know, that's another piece of his humility. You know, he's willing to go along with his wife. You know, unlike the elves who don't seem to listen to their wives here,
yes.
Thingol doesn't listen anyway. You know, he really doesn't put himself ahead. He puts other people's wishes ahead of his own. And in that way, too, it's different from what happened with Aragorn and Beren, where, you know, both of their wives chose to become mortal. And the Valar did not offer that choice to the men in those cases.
Yeah. No, it's certainly, that is the huge difference. I mean, it's not just the circumstances, the entire nature of the relationship, the whole like metaphysical outcome of this union between elves and men is different. The one thing I would emphasize about that we have to be careful. The text here is deliberately dodgy about Tuor's fate. Worth reading that last paragraph. In those days, Tuor felt old age creep upon him, and ever a longing for the deeps of the sea grew stronger in his heart. Therefore, he built a great ship, and he named it Earame, which is Sea Wing, and with Idril Celebrimbor he set sail into the sunset in the west, and came no more into any tale or song. But in after days it was sung that Tuor alone of mortal men was numbered among the elder race, and was joined with the Noldor whom he loved, and his fate is sundered from the fate of men. But in after days it was sung that Tuor alone of mortal men. But we don't know. We don't know for sure. Nobody sees him again. If he's off being immortal somewhere, if he is joined to elves, where is he? With Olmo? Ever a longing for the deeps of the sea grew stronger in his heart. And that echoes the language that we get at the beginning of the chapter. And looking upon Belagair, the great sea, he was enamored of it, and the sound of it and the longing for it was ever in his heart and ear, and an unquiet was on him that took him at last into the depths of the realms of Olmo. Sorry, Laura, go ahead.
I would say if it's in song, it's got to be true, right? I mean, in Tolkien, if you put it in a song, you know, it's like gospel. It's written in stone. But, you know, I thought that... Because Olmo used him as an instrument, that he was offered this choice. I'm getting tired too. I can't remember my point.
But just to respond to the song thing, I mean, the point there is not that necessarily that we really should question that it's probably not really true, just because they're singing about it doesn't make it true, but rather the kind of squirrely way that the text says that we're not told definitely, we're not told by the narrator, thus Tuor was joined unto the fate of elves, but rather we're told that the later elves believed that Tuor and sang songs about the idea that Tuor was joined. But what we see him, we know he's mortal because he's getting old. He's feeling old age creep upon him, right? So we see mortal Tuor, old mortal Tuor, setting sail. Goodbye, old mortal Tuor. And he's never heard from again. Now the elves sing that he was joined, but it's never confirmed. It's never given that kind of objective certainty. I think it's kind of interesting the way that's left open. Go ahead, Laura.
I think you have to let us have our happy, wishful thinking ending here.
And that's fine. I'm not saying that I disbelieve it. I'm not saying that, really it's all a sham and they just like shipwrecked out of sight of land and everybody died. I'm not saying that that's true. I'm just saying I think that it is an interesting choice to leave that kind of open, especially since, assuming that's true, Tuor is completely unique, as the text says there in that last line. He alone of all men was joined to it, and what would that look like? What would happen to him? Well, we don't know, and we never see, because Tuor's gone. Dave?
I personally think the shipwreck story is the truth.
Where do you find that in the text, Dave?
I think he fell overboard and the elves decided that this made a better story. Poor guy. He was like 10 feet from land and he fell overboard. He was so old, he drowned. And I don't know. I can't see that.
Dave, you would not say that if Roland Flieger were in the room and you know it.
No, definitely not.
I should probably take a second to explain to our other listeners who were not at MythCon. We keep referring to Verlyn Flieger because she was at MythCon, and we were all very impressed by not only by the talk that she gave, but in the very active discussion that followed after it. She was extremely tough, in ways which I found very, very delightful. She was talking about the Silmarils, and a lot of people were afterwards wanting to respond to her talk by bringing forth theories. I think it works like this, or I think they mean that. But she was really, really tough and kept coming back and saying, essentially, that story that you're telling right now is a nice story, but I don't see it in the text. You're adding stuff. And what she kept challenging people very appropriately was, it's so easy for us to fill in the gaps when we read these things, especially in stories like Tuor, because it's certainly this version of the Tuor story, because it's so spare, it's so brief. I mean, there's so many not holes in it in the sense of contradiction, but gaps, blank spaces that are just being leaped over by this, very distantly surveying narrative. It's very tempting for us to fill in gaps and say, well, here's probably how it really happened. Here's probably what was actually going on. Here's what really happened to Tuor and Idril. But in doing that, we are adding what we, our own stuff to the text. And Verlyn persistently refused to let people do that. And she would call them on it every time they were doing it. And so that's why there's been for the rest of the weekend and kind of ever since, and in the throughout the text chat tonight, you know, it's been kind of a running joke. People keep saying, you know, where is it in the text? I didn't see that in the text. Everyone is quoting Verlin Flieger there.
Let me give you a little text. It's not terribly well researched. It's just a notion that this is one of those things that, again, makes me wonder what he was doing with this version of this story, because you don't tend to see that kind of thing, like an exceptional character like that, where they change the rules for somebody. Like they make it perfectly clear time and again, especially in the Akala Beth, they say, we're not allowed to take death away from you, you know? And indeed, if there were this exception of Tur, that would be a counter-argument for the Numenoreans when they go and say, we want to live forever. And the Valar say, hey, we're not allowed to take that away from you. Hey, whoa, wait a minute. What about Tur? You know, right. What about our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Tur? You took it away from him. And indeed, I generally think that people, the characters in Lord of the Rings and in Silmarillion, and indeed all of Tolkien's work, tend to be, when you have characters who sort of fall into a pattern, like Beren and Tur and Aragorn, they don't tend to be glaring contradictions or characters that are just like, well, there's these two guys who follow a certain pattern, and this other guy who, for no reason, is a complete contradiction and is the opposite. Unless, of course, maybe Tolkien was sort of changing his mind. But I feel like if there was one of these three guys who would get this exceptional treatment, it would have been Aragorn. Mm-hmm. Because he's sort of the fulfillment of everything that is laid down in these chapters in the unions of men and elves. So that's not direct evidence, but I feel like the fact that he leaves it so vague, as you point out, and that it would be such a bizarre, glaring contradiction to not only the pattern that we see with other similar characters, but also the actual dictums of the Valar saying, we can't take death away from men. That's Iluvatar's gift. We're not allowed to take it away. Makes me think that he's leaving it vague intentionally, and that maybe perhaps he as he was writing this wasn't thinking, yes, and I believe this is what happened to Tur, that he was writing it because it was an interesting story for the elves to be telling.
Right. It is an unusual and remarkable tradition among the elves that Tur became immortal. In one sense, you know, he certainly is kind of dodging some things here, because there is that precedent, and only Iluvatar could do that. I mean, but you know, even looking at their ultimate fate, are we to read? I mean, with your shipwreck story there, Dave, are we reading the deeps of the sea as meaning death? Like, you know, we're speaking euphemistically, like, and they've gone to be with Olmo, right? That means they're shipwrecked. Or does it? Or does it mean that they literally, I mean, are we to imagine that, like, you know, Tur and Idril actually go, you know, and they're like, hey, we're going to go hang out with Olmo now. I don't know. Both at the beginning and at the end of the story, we get that same language about the deeps of the sea. Ever a longing for the deeps of the sea. Does that mean being in a ship far out to sea, you know, where it's deep? Or does it mean actually for the deeps of the sea themselves? Because that's where Omo lives, down in the deeps of the sea. I don't know.
I have to jump in here.
Okay.
If Dave's theory is correct, then it doesn't explain Luthien. For the same should be true, then, that the Valar can't give death to the elves. And at the same point, it's just as likely, as Dave rewrites the chapter, that we could rewrite the chapter to say that as he went out looking for the deeps of the sea, Olmo went to Iluvatar and said, hey, let this guy come live with me. So if we're going to rewrite the chapter, we might as well as rewrite it however we'd like.
Yeah, Laura, what do you think? You want to intervene in the debate here?
Yeah, here comes the rebuttal to Dave. You know, I think it's just as likely that Iluvatar himself would have stepped in and said, you know, Tuor, he was chosen by Omo to be his instrument, you know, and so I would say that's pretty clear choice that he's a chosen one, and that, you know, in return for doing all these things for Omo, that he would be granted this request in return. And I, you know, it doesn't say that anywhere, obviously, but I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that. And also, as far as you know, having the you know, elf or the human man and the elf woman, and the elf woman becomes mortal. You know, in the case of Arwen and Aragorn, it's not exactly the same, because Arwen has the choice to become mortal. She's half elven, so it's not exactly the same there. She can choose to be of the mortal race, mm-hmm. And you know, and there's also that other exception in Finrod Andreth, where you have the mortal woman and the elf man.
Yes.
You know, and that's kind of an obscure story that's in the history of Middle-earth that a lot of people haven't read. But, you know, that's another exception to the pattern. So I don't think we need to take that pattern as something that's set in stone. I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that that there could have been a different outcome this time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's I mean, you're certainly right to remember that, though, of course, there, that was not in the sense that these three that we're talking about are, that is, the story of Andreth and Aignor, is not a union in this sense, because they don't get married and nobody's fate is changed. Andreth remains a mortal woman, and Aignor remains an immortal elf, and you know, he is changed and affected by it, but they are not joined, and their fates are not joined. So I wouldn't, for that reason, I wouldn't put them in this category. And in fact, that's, you know, one of the things that Finrod talks to Andreth about in that discussion. You know, when they're talking about that, is basically the separation between the two of them, like the fact that they haven't gotten together, and that even though their love for each other was mutual, in the end, really, it's a relationship that never happened.
Well, except that Finrod does say, and I've forgotten his brother's name, that he is waiting for her. Yeah, Aignor. That he is waiting for her in the halls of Mandos. So he must have some hope that perhaps someday they will be able to get together.
Right. You know? No, possibly. Again, and I'm not trying to say that. Again, I'm not saying to say that their love for each other isn't mutual, and that they have no relationship at all. I mean, goodness knows, you know, it's not like Turin and Finduilus's non-relationship, but they are, you know, this side of Mandos, they are not joining. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, we're not given any indication that there's going to be a joining necessarily. But certainly,
yeah,
nobody's fate.
I mean, I'm just saying it's just something different than the typical thing that we mm-hmm. see. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think we always have to just go by, okay, it's always an elf woman and it's always a mortal man and the elf woman always dies. You know, I don't think we need to follow that as, you know, a strict pattern that's not going to vary or change.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, it's we should be careful not to expand that too much. But yeah, certainly when you take the three big ones, certainly in lots of ways, for many of the reasons we've been talking about, Tuor and Ijil are different. But we've only got about 20 minutes left, and we haven't talked about the fall of Gondolin at all. So let's talk about that. Anyone want to talk about Maeglin? Or the actual destruction of the city, or Glorfindel. I know we want to talk about Glorfindel a little bit. Anybody? Go ahead and jump in if you have. Let me just mention in passing, because I've talked about this in much detail before in an earlier podcast episode. One of the big questions that people have when they read this, especially, you know, when Lord of the Rings fans read The Silmarillion for the first time and they get to the story of yellow-haired Glorfindel,
it the same Glorfindel?
It is indeed. Thank you for asking, Dave. Yes, it's the same Glorfindel. He is one of the two main captains of Gondolin. The other is Ecthelion, who kills Gothmog, Lord of Balrogs, and dies. And it is Tolkien was very explicit about the fact that he had brought him back. And this was not just sort of an evolutionary thing. This is not just, sort of Tolkien, the king of retcon, striking again, having come up with a character named Glorfindel twice and needing to find an explanation of it. It was always an unusual thing. Elves don't get named after each other. Generally, of course, why would they? They're immortal. So, I mean, like, you don't exactly, if you're an elf, you don't, you know, name your son after his grandfather or something, because then, like, they're going to be hanging out together pretty soon, or you know, if they're not already. So no, that generally doesn't happen among elves. But anyway, no, Glorfindel, this is the same dude, and especially as Tolkien, later on in his life, wrote more about this to explain kind of the mechanics of this, that Glorfindel is basically given another chance to go back to Middle-earth. We know that elves, you know, their spirits do not depart Arda. When they die, their souls go to Mandos for a while and seem to have some kind of purgatorial experience over there. Fëanor probably still there because he's got a heck of a lot of purgatory in front of him. But Glorfindel is let out. We know that they can basically make new bodies for themselves, are given new bodies, and are allowed to sort of, you know, go back out into general population in Valinor. But very few, and Glorfindel is the primary example, are not only allowed to get out of Mandos and circulate in Valinor, but actually to return to Middle-earth, because, you know, he sort of had unfinished business there in Middle-earth. And because he was really great, and, you know, the self-sacrifice of his death, you know, he died the death of a saint, and he was like the opposite of Fëanor, actually. It's kind of an interesting contrast when you think about their forms of death, both of them being killed by Balrogs, but boy, is there a big difference between Fëanor's death by Balrog and Glorfindel's death by Balrog. So yes, they are the same. The same Glorfindels. Other thoughts? Maeglin thoughts? Attack of the City? I know, Laura, your thought that the description is extremely brief. Yes. Glorfindel goes down, or Gondolin goes down pretty quickly.
I was wondering, why is Turgon, he dies in a tower?
Yes.
It seems almost like a cowardly end for the High King of the Noldor, that he doesn't die seemingly in battle, that he dies holed up in his tower, and as it collapses, so falls he as well.
Yeah. I agree. It is a remarkable passage, and I think that stylistically, here we go, Mike. Time for style time. We haven't been doing style time enough recently, but I think that we should definitely have a style time moment. I think that we get a stylistic clue from Tolkien to pay attention to exactly the thing that Jordan was just talking about. Reading the last paragraph, this is the last full paragraph on page 242. Of the deeds of desperate valor, they're done by the chieftains of the noble houses and their warriors, and not least by Tuor, much is told in the fall of Gondolin, of the battle of Ecthelion of the Fountain with Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, in the very square of the king, where each slew the other, and of the defence of the Tower of Turgon by the people of his household, until the tower was overthrown, and mighty was its fall, and the fall of Turgon in its ruin. And we have this elevation of style here, and that final sort of form, I don't mean formulaic in the sense of like, oh, it's just like fits to a pat pattern, but rather that it's, he invokes these sort of heroic formulas, the repetitions that we get there, until the tower was overthrown, and mighty was its fall, and the fall of Turgon in its ruin. What is emphasized right before that, of the deeds of desperate valor, they're done. And Jordan's right. Okay, Turgon, where's the desperate valor? Everyone else is being desperately valiant. Where are you? There's Ecthelion fighting and dying in the very square of the king. We've got the defense of the Tower of Turgon by the people of his household. Now, I don't think we're supposed to understand, and in the previous versions, it is not that Turgon is just holed up. He is not Denethor, hiding away and focusing on committing suicide while his city is under attack. That's not what Turgon is doing. But yet in this one-sentence description of the downfall of Gondolin here. Nothing is, you know, Turgon is given in this sentence a completely passive role in direct contrast to the, you know, these sort of carefully structured and paralleled other people who are being so desperately valiant. What do you make of that, the collapse of his tower? If the message here is not supposed to be and Turgon died a coward's death and was a weenie, I don't think we're supposed to be taking that from that passage. Certainly I don't think that's supposed to be the primary message. But what do we take from it? What do you think? Joe, what do you think?
Different topic. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Does anyone have any thoughts about Turgon and his tower?
Well, I mean, Jack points out in the text, it seems like he's a captain going down with a ship, and maybe that is it, that he's sort of, I mean, the only argument I guess you could make is that he's overseeing the battle itself,
mm-hmm.
And that from the highest point, I assume, in the city, he is attempting to strategize and win the day, and then is destroyed while the city itself is destroyed.
Yeah, certainly. And I think especially that last connection, that he is destroyed while the city itself is destroyed. The collapse of the Great Tower, is the last, you know, sort of at least symbolically, if not literally, the final stage of the destruction of the city. So Turgon does go down with the ship, an ironic turn of phrase in this chapter, especially thinking about Tuor and his fate. But Chris, you were thinking a similar thing to Jack and to Jordan there.
Yeah, I think I was minded of I'm having a brain fade here. Directing the battle from above, that would seem reasonable. I don't think he was a coward.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that. Again, at least symbolically, he is not. But remember, Turgon going down with the ship is not noble in the way that... And I don't think he's dying a coward's death, but I also don't think that he's dying the sort of noble death that a ship captain is dying under those circumstances. You know, I mean, that phrase is normally used in a sort of a complimentary way, you know, that a ship captain is doing his self-sacrificial duty if he goes down with his ship. But remember, that's not... He was told the ship was going to... He was told to get the heck off the ship, and he refused to get off the ship. He didn't have to go down with his ship. In fact, his job was to obey and listen to Olmo and get the heck out of the ship before it went down. But he is going down with it because he was so all-fired convinced that though Avala could gainsay it, the ship wasn't coming down. And he turned out to be wrong about that. As Jack says, he was all in. Yeah, yeah. Once he defies Olmo and says, I'm going to stay, he is all in. And at least he does stay all in all the way through. But no, I mean, I think that this is, in a sense, then I think the final emblem of his pride as well, you know, that he is taking refuge. Him taking refuge in this tower is like him stubbornly sticking to Gondolin until the city itself comes down around him. So the fact that his great tower built by his own hands in his great city ultimately is his cause of death. I mean, he is crushed within his tower as it collapses. So that, because, you know, in his sticking to Gondolin, Gondolin itself took him down, certainly at the very least appropriate. Joe, you wanted to talk about Maeglin. Let's do that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it seems like the curse of Aeol is fulfilled very much so here. Maeglin meets the very same end as his dad, pretty much. He gets tossed over the edge more so. I guess you can't really call it a punishment, even though he extremely deserved it. But, because Aeol said, so you forsake your father and his kin, ill-gotten son. Here you shall fail all of all your hopes, and here may you yet die the same death as I. Yep. It pretty much goes just like that.
Yes. And remember that when Aeol dies, he is executed after his trial. He kills Arathel, his wife. Now, he wasn't trying to kill her. He was trying to kill Maeglin, which, of course, it would have been better off had he succeeded. But He is tried and executed for murder in that place. And the parallel does create this sort of wonderful moment where Maegwin is not given a trial. He has committed one of the most, as we are told, one of the most notorious acts of evil in the entire First Age. His is the most infamous of all of the betrayals by anybody in the First Age. And he never comes to trial, but yet we see justice is done anyway. And the fact that he is not just perishing, but being punished is strongly emphasized by that parallel, is strongly emphasized by the fact that he ends up getting hucked off the same cliff that his dad was hucked off of.
Pitched into the flames is something I want to point out.
Yes, pitched into the flames. And the detail, the seemingly wholly unnecessary detail of how many times he strikes the side of the cliff on his way down, I find very interesting. Mike, go ahead.
Stole my thunder.
No, go ahead, go ahead. I didn't say anything about it.
The graphic detail of him hitting the mountainside three times before disappearing into flames. I mean, it's just like, okay, we get it. Punishment. There you go. It was almost like Coyote versus Roadrunner Acme. Like, okay, he's really gonna hurt. This is going to hurt.
Yeah. No, I agree. But I think also there's more than that too. And his body, as it fell, smote the rocky slopes of Amanguara thrice ere it pitched into the flames below. I always feel it's a moment that leaves me kind of tantalized, you know, that I don't know what to make of it, but I feel like there's something we should make of that, you know, that there's some kind of significance there to the striking of it three times. I'm not sure what it is, but it seems so unnecessary to say that, and so unlike the rest of this narrative. You know, we've talked about before in previous style times, we have talked about this trend where we have this narrative from far up, and then the narrative kind of swoops down to more precise detail. We don't get that same kind of shift here. We don't get the one that's jumping out in my mind that was similar to this was that moment in the battle before the Battle of Sudden Flame, way back on page 150, when we get, "There came a time of winter when the night was dark and without moon, and the wide plain of Ardgallen stretched dim beneath the cold stars, from the hill forts of the Noldor to the feet of Thangorodrim. The watchfires burned low and the guards were few." We don't get anything like that in this passage. So it's not like we're actually changing register and the narrative is going in a different direction. It's just within the voice, within the style of that same "I'm telling the story from a mile above the ground" kind of narrative, which we get throughout this chapter, in the middle of that, we are given this one detail, "and his body as it fell smote the rocky slopes of Amangara thrice ere it pitched into the flames below." I don't know what to do with it, but I feel like we should do something. Mike, go ahead.
Perhaps another reason why you're lingering on that is the phrase cast him out. There's sort of a micro, biblical thing going on here with Tuor and Maeglin. So, maybe you're picking up on some sort of, small scale punishment that's being vetted out in a very limited way. There's the casting out of one character by another, and then some sort of vetting of punishment on top of it. Maybe mm-hmm. that's also what's coming through.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe that's what I'm thinking about. I mean, certainly it does. We don't usually get, we've been saying sort of casually that, Maegwin is being punished here, but that has not usually been the case. We have not generally seen people who do bad things necessarily get their comeuppance in this kind of obviously apparent and satisfying way. That's not been the rule by any stretch. So it's kind of interesting that we seem to get that sort of satisfaction here. I think that it's we shouldn't just take it for granted. Joe?
All right, this is kind of moving further down that paragraph to where it talks about the fumes and the burning. It says, the fume of the burning and the steam of the fair fountains of Gondolin withering in the flame of the dragons of the north fell upon the Vale of Tumladen in mournful mist. Just, it seems like the emotion in that is just, like, extreme, and it reminds me of, like, the very beginning, Olmo describing how, like, beautiful, like, the mist and the rain was, and everything connected to water. And here again, you see, even through, like, the mourning of the water coming down in the mist and the misery of everything being destroyed, I mean, the mist comes down and aids the escape of everybody. Just the emotion and almost the beauty of that sad, those sad few sentences just really kind of captured my attention.
That is fantastic, Joe. That is my favorite comment of the whole night so far. You're absolutely right. Remember first that Gondolin was associated with fountains from the beginning. The original name that Turgon gave it was the rock of the music of water. So it's been associated with its fountains all the way along. And so this image of the flames destroying Gondolin and the flames of the dragons consuming it, and encountering these fountains and the mist from that rising up does look like, and see, look, the beauty of Gondolin is destroyed. But Joe, you're exactly right to recall what happens when, because Melkor has devised heat intemperate as part of his discord that he introduced to the music. Well, as Iluvatar tells Olmo, our protagonist of this chapter, Olmo, the extremes of cold and heat have not destroyed the beauty of Olmo's domain, that is of the water, because from them comes the snowflake, and from them comes the rainfall and the mist. And the beauty of his realm is increased by it. And I think that that is a memory here. And as you say, it is the mist itself becomes the instrument to preserve, the tool by which the instruments of Olmo's will and the prophecy, the fulfillment of Huor's prophecy, are preserved. I think that that's a really great thing to remember. Well, we are out of time, and we leave with the 7-year-old Eärendil leaving with his mom and dad out of Gondolin and going down to the Isle of Balar, where now we have the last enclave. Now everything has fallen. We had, at first we had, all of Beleriand ruined after the Battle of Sudden Flame, and only these three islands left within Beleriand. We had Nargothrond and Doriath and Gondolin, and in three consecutive chapters we've seen all of them destroyed. So now we have one final settlement. All of those realms which you guys read with so much fascination and interest in, of Beleriand and its realms, are now all reduced to this one combined people. You've got the remnant of Círdan the shipwright and his people are down there. You've got the refugees from Doriath who come down with Elwing, and now we have the refugees from Gondolin coming down there too, and that's the last settlement of elves, sort of the last large-scale peaceful settlement of elves in Beleriand at all right now, and that's where we will begin our final story of Eärendil, the greatest of the heroes in all of Tolkien's legendarium. He is the greatest of all the heroic figures in all of Tolkien's stories, Eärendil. So when we will look at him next week. And yes, Mike, as you say, they go down the River Sirion. That is the river that is sacred to Olmo. Again, there's no, Olmo's fingerprints are on like every paragraph of this chapter. Okay, excellent. Thanks, everybody. I look forward to, we will actually finish the Quintus Silmarillion next week. That's kind of amazing to contemplate. All right, so we're going to say goodnight now. Thanks everybody for listening. Sorry again for interrupting the Mythgard show. But we will get a chance to get back to that. One final sort of plug and apology I'll give if anyone is listening who's been trying to go to the Mythgard site tonight. The Mythgard Institute website was down briefly. We had a transition. We have a new version of the Mythgard site up, and it It is now up, and the email is working again, and our form is fixed. A couple of people were trying to apply to the for the master's degree course and were not able to connect to the form. That's fixed now. So as far as I know, everything is now working properly. So if you had any troubles before, go back and try it again. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, and we will see you next week.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode and will continue to listen to the future podcasts, which should be coming faster than this one. I'll admit, I have held up the process. I want to thank you all for taking this journey with us. It was always a blast recording these things, and I hope you all enjoy them as well. On behalf of the Silmarillionaires, this is Joe Stoll. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.